Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane Patreon channel, where queer friends and allies get to talk about nerdy, obscure characters, like supporting characters, like the weirdly relevant and consistent character Peter Corbeau, who does everything but also kind of never really does anything. He's the panic guy. He likes to hit panic buttons from space and wear sailor caps. And that's basically the character summed up in one sentence, but this was a fun dive into a character I have never given a lot of thought to. I know Jay from Jay and Miles is really fond of this character, which is really fun, and it's going to be our own unique take. And I get to meet with two friends from real life who also happen to be two handsome climate scientists. So this will be a fun evening for me where I just get to learn all kinds of nerdy things. Let me welcome both of my guests. I'll have you both introduce yourselves with your name and pronouns. Let us know a little about yourself, and I'd love to hear your initial thoughts on Peter Corbeau and what makes him unique? Question mark in the Marvel Universe. Let's begin with Daniel Guilford returning to the show. Hi, Daniel. It's great to see you.
Hey, Chad. Thanks so much for having me again. It's really exciting to be here and talking about this character. My name is Dr. Daniel Guilford. I'm a climate scientist. I use he and they pronouns. I spend a lot of time thinking about how communities around the world are being affected by climate change and the extent to which human beings are responsible for that. So I do a science called climate attribution science, where we try to put numbers on the extent to which human beings are responsible for certain things. And my real passion is hurricanes. I live in Florida, and Florida is really threatened by hurricanes a lot of the time. So it's something that's really important to me. And I love Dr. Peter Corbeau, not just because he's a ridiculously awesome scientist with a very cool cap, but because he is the embodiment of the spirit of adventure.
Ooh, an interesting take already. Let me also welcome Derek Nichols back to the show. Hi, Derek, great to see you.
Hey, good to see you too, both of you. So I'm Derek Nichols. My pronouns are he and they. I am currently in Buffalo, New York. It's kind of where I've been for a while now. My day job, I work for a university here. So I want not to correct you, Chad. I'm not a scientist. That title scares me. So I went to school for urban planning. So I've worked in like the activist realm with climate at the university that I work at. My job is to steward our climate action plan. So making our operations more sustainable, also tapping into the wealth of knowledge that our climate scientists, that our faculty have to make an impact here locally as well as globally. One of my passions involving all of that is the justice side of everything. So, I work for an institution. It's an anchoring institution here in Western New York. What are our climate impacts on the community that surround us immediately and then long term? So I like to frame out things that way with my work. So, and in regards to Peter Corbeau, like I said, not a scientist. So like when I first started learning about him, like he's a physics, like Nobel Prize winner in physics, I stayed away from every physics class I possibly could because that's just not how my brain works. But I think he is actually relatable in many ways. One of the few grounded, relatable geniuses in the Marvel Universe.
Geniuses are always an interesting category in life, in fiction. Geniuses are people who tend to have high drive, high interest, high logic, but often poor people skills, right? We can look at someone like Howard Hughes. I design planes and I also make movies and I also, whatever. Elon Musk, who like is designing cars, but also buying social media networks, influencing politics, and building rockets. There's this kind of odd thing where people will do a whole bunch of stuff. Mark Zuckerberg is mapping the genome while reforming world politics through social media. Just craziness, right? When we look at really high impact people, we look at scientists who some of them have very high respect in the real world. And this is where names like Stephen Hawking come in. And we automatically go, oh, that's an amazing person. Neil deGrasse Tyson, oh, that's an amazing person. And I think Peter Corbeau, first thing we want to establish is he is much more Neil deGrasse Tyson and much less Tony Stark, which is fair. He seems to be a decent guy and he has a lot of really variable interests. Do you guys want to list some of the things that Peter Corbeau is a genius in?
Astrophysics, I think, is
Yes.
one of the first ones that jumps to mind. He's kind of always dabbling in science around astrophysics.
Sailing. He's really good at
Sailing. He's
sailing.
really into sailing. Yeah.
He is a sailing for sure. Is he an expert in sailing? He gets attacked by sentinels like right away.
He's an
It's not really
expert
testament
in.
to his sailing skills, though.
Oh, that's true.
He's an expert in gamma radiation. He's an expert in space travel and the sun itself. I don't know how much that intersects with astrophysics, with stargates. He seems to have a little bit of knowledge in a lot of things, which is
There's
really
like time
interesting.
travel stuff at some
Yeah.
point. And I was like, wait, he's becoming a bit of a generalist here.
He's that guy, you know how like Marvel has like that old like group of 60 scientists from Hank Pym to Hank McCoy to
Right.
Tony Stark to Reed Richards, and they kind of just know a little bit of everything. Hank Pym is obsessed with like size changing things, but he's also a biochemist, but he also designs robots, including genocidal ones. And you're like, oh, okay, that's a lot. Early announcement, we're going to be doing a script reading, the three of us together, which we will be recording right around the time this episode comes out, where Daniel's going to be coming back to play Hank Pym. So Dr. Daniel Guilford playing Dr. Henry Pym, typecasting? Question mark.
I really hope not. I hope this is not a typecasting based at least on Hank's personality. I do not want to be compared to
Where
that.
Derek Nichols will be playing Thor, typecasting? Question mark.
100%. Totally agree.
Thor is pretty badass.
I would love to. We're going to begin with just some climate science stuff. Daniel, will you share with everybody a little bit how you ended up on your career track and what it is that fascinates you about the world in 2025?
Yeah, so when I was about 16 years old, I was living through Hurricane Jean in 2004. It smashed a tree in my backyard and it was tumbling towards the windows. I was staring out at the tree tumbling towards me. My mother yelled, "Duck!" I didn't duck, and here I am, climate scientist, just a few years later. That is actually what happened. I did get sort of swept away by the imagination and the beauty and the strength of the storm, and I wanted to understand it better. I had this visceral experience of how important these storms were for the communities that I love. And so I wanted to serve those communities by understanding these storms, how they're being influenced by climate, how they're varying over time and space. Understand these things and bring those back to the community so that we can protect more people and more communities from these damaging and beautiful storms. So I view science very much as this lens through which I see the world. I see this very beautiful thing, this very terrifying thing, these hurricanes, for instance. Climate change is also one of those very beautiful, complex problems, but very terrifying in its impacts on human beings. So I've been working on this problem now for maybe about 15 years, and it's really gripped me. Now I have children of my own, concerned about their future. I'm concerned about where we're going as a people. I really want us to be working towards, making a more equitable, more flourishing future for our children. And so that's why I work on this problem today. I work on a nonprofit space trying to put out information to the world to communicate how climate is changing and what we should do about it. And what we should do about it, first and foremost, is what we're doing right now tonight. Just talk about it.
So I work as a crisis responder, often online, often remotely. I spent a couple of weeks working with a lot of businesses in North Carolina after the recent hurricanes. A lot of people who lost their homes or were like stuck at home without power or resources for a long period of time. And there was this great sense of like the world keeps going even when you're in crisis, right? If you're taking care of your elderly mom, or you got triplets at home, or you are homebound and unable to access the resources, or your medicine runs out, like the world keeps going whether you are there or not. And one of the things that really stood out to me is how everybody was overwhelmed together, but most people had stories about people really coming together and working together. And that like inspiration of humanity is a beautiful thing. As we're recording this in early January, I've been looking at stories on social media all day about the wildfires in California and people coming together and helping. And of course, again, tremendous loss. But stories like this, when I see people overwhelmed by an act of God or creation, if you will, and I'm not a person who believes in God, but anything that falls into that category, I think people have a way of really drawing together in a way that I find very, very inspiring. Derek, do you want to give a little bit of your own preamble? Like, how did you end up where you are?
Yeah, and I feel like this is such a like I'm pandering to the audience, but honestly, I was became fascinated with the weather by watching the X-Men cartoon and be like falling in love with Storm. Like my first book report in fifth grade was on the weather because I was so like number one storm fan, you know. So
That's
that kind
awesome.
of set my trajectory off. And you know, in another life, I'd love to be like a meteorologist. But you know, I went to school. I really wanted to focus on disaster planning and urban planning. So I had an opportunity to do things like I went to Columbia and I presented on a tornado outbreak, but and that happened close by in Canada to a bunch of Colombians because they were thinking about how do we plan for our volcano eruption. And so it was more about the response and reaction to disasters policy-wise. And then, you know, through grad school, focused on the disaster preparedness, disaster communication, community organizing, and now being like a citizen in the Buffalo area, climate change is going to hit this region a little bit differently than others. People along the coasts are going to get severe storms, flooding. Western New York, where I'm from, has been labeled like a climate refuge. And that is kind of contentious here because we'll have extremes in our storms that we have now, but we won't see massive like flooding or disruption. So people are saying like, hey, let's open it up. And Buffalo is a Rust Belt city. And there it was in population decline. So there are, you know, politicians and residents here that are excited for an influx, but the people who have been living here for decades, who have been disinvested in and need services and need better access to infrastructure, they're, you know, there are communities here that are resentful of that notion because we should be taking care of who we have here currently. And that was a testament 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, I'm losing track of time, when Buffalo had that blizzard on Christmas that killed 40, 50, about 50 people. That showed like the breakdown of disinvestment because, you know, a disproportionate number of people of our Black residents died compared to white residents in the county, just because
Simply
of.
related to access to resources. On a sociological level, because I think we come from a generation, at least our parents, in this kind of post-World War II white privilege era where we had a group of people thinking that they were just the best fucking thing that ever happened to the planet, right? The Christian culture of like, you were saved for a special time and you're raised in this generation. And there was like kind of an invulnerability feeling that showed up. And in our generation, as the economy is crashing and the population is expanding and the resources are growing limited, we're panicking about our children. Where our parents were just like, let's have all the babies. You know, it's a very different time. It gives me a lot of Game of Thrones vibes where everybody's just warring with each other while the White Walkers are up in the north ready to just descend on all of us. Salt Lake City does not get a lot of inclemently bad weather, but there's been some really interesting things where I live. We had a windstorm here a few years ago that knocked over a bunch of things. During the pandemic, we had an earthquake here, which never happens. And then there's all been all these like really creepy reports about if the Great Salt Lake actually dries up, which it's been in significant danger of doing, it's going to release like a poison in the air that will make the valley uninhabitable in a certain amount of time. And everyone's like, save the lake, save the lake. And it's really fucking scary. When you see things like this in the news, whether you're on the coast or in the mountains, you're like, oh man, what are we going to do? And Peter Corbeau weirdly kind of represents that energy in the Marvel Universe. I feel like every one of his appearances is like, danger, danger, we're going to die. It's like we have to narrowly avert it through some sort of superhero action. It's kind of scary. I don't know.
Is that he's the constant like panic. And that's why I said he's relatable, right? Like, because I
But he's
think,
also right every time.
yeah,
He
exactly.
is. He's right
Yeah.
every
If Peter
time.
Corbeau calls, you fucking listen because he knows what he. This is not Iron Man pushing the panic button because he's having an emotional crisis. This man is right every time.
He is very tragically right often as well. He often can be right, but in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, the story we're going to go into, I'm sure, with the X-Men, he leads the X-Men to going to eventually lead to the Dark Phoenix saga, eventually, you know, down the road. But he is a key prime person in sort of kicking that off. I think of him as very much as like this adventurous spirit, but he also brings with him this kind of danger. Anytime he's in the room, he's getting excited about what's going on. Everyone else is feeling the panic, but I don't feel like he's feeling the panic.
I think Peter is good at equating all the data, right? If I'm going to keep going back to Hank Pym or Reed Richards here. Hank Pym builds a robot and he uses like his brain engrams in it. And that robot ends up becoming genocidal, right? Iron Man builds that device to like contain the Phoenix Force, but it ends up splitting it into five and like the unpredictable results thing. Do you guys know the character, the Mad Thinker, who's always like, Mwahaha, I can predict everything except for that one thing? Who could have predicted that Deadpool was going to have acorns in his pocket during the fight? Now I'm defeated again, right? Peter Corbeau's not that guy. Peter Corbeau, when there's something that shows up, he she's willing to recollate the data. When something like the Phoenix Force suddenly shows up at the doorstep, he goes, "Oh, here's this thing I don't understand, and I'm ready to like recalibrate now." He's not stubborn in that way. And I think the resilience of this character, like the way that that is kind of a through line for him, is really interesting. Let's delve into his first appearance, which is a shocking one in some ways. We know Chris Claremont really latches onto the characters he creates in other titles and will often bring them into the X-Men. He does that with characters from his Ms. Marvel stuff, from he even brought the N'Garai in from, like, I don't know, some monster comic that he wrote early in Marvel's days. Warhawk is another one they face in the early X-Men. In Incredible Hulk 148 is where we first meet Peter Corbo. This is in February 1972, the era that my show was in all through 2024. This is an Archie Goodwin and Chris Claremont story with Herb Trimpe on art. The story's called "But Tomorrow the Sun Shall Die," and so we automatically begin in a drama place. We open on Thunderbolt Ross, Betty Ross, and Glenn Talbot, who are supervising the construction of Project Greenskin. And this is where we meet Dr. Peter Corbeau. He's dressed in a green striped pants and a turtleneck and a plaid purple jacket. This man is a fashion icon. He does all his shopping at thrift stores, I think.
It's the worst. It's the worst outfit. His outfit on the boat is much better. His fashion sense grows over time, in my
He's got a
opinion.
little bit of like Sheldon from Big Bang Theory energy about him
Yes,
sometimes, you know?
absolutely.
So he's looking out at the construction of this personal project. Then Thunderbolt Ross, who's the big military rah rah rah, you know, guy, says, "We'll nail the Hulk for you, Corbeau, but hanged if I see how that orbiting hoosus of yours out in space can turn him back into Bruce Banner permanently." Yet now it was fact, the world's first orbiting solar reactor, a fact that might be the salvation of a colleague, a friend, Robert Bruce Banner. We meet Peter Corbeau. He's introduced as a doctor of physics, a Nobel Prize winner. He smiles. He's used to people who doubt, who don't understand. Haven't they refused to believe in his greatest triumph, StarCorps I, which we'll talk about in a moment? Corbeau responds to the general, "Of course you're skeptical, General. You have heard many such theories and seen them fail. But once this receiver unit is set up, I think we'll see mine succeed, provided naturally that you capture the Hulk." And so the Hulkbusters, they're the military guys, they capture the Hulk with deadly artillery. They bring him back to Corbeau. He thinks, "Trapped inside that brute is a man I roomed with at college, a man I drank with, laughed with over the years, until this." Now let's talk about mad science that goes wrong. Bruce Banner is the fucking Hulk after his bomb was designed. But he's loyal to Banner in a way that we don't really ever see followed up on after this issue, which is interesting. He activates a laser beam transviewer that is monitoring his StarCorps space station as it faces the sun. Then he activates the, quote, "hydrogen helium reactor," which draws energy from the sun, projecting it to Earth and relaying it to a, quote, "solar wave receiver," which then filters the Hulk's body, penetrating his body's atoms in order to neutralize the gamma radiation in this form and thus cure him of being the Hulk. Now, Hulk cries out in pain, but he's pleased in the end because he's changed back to Bruce Banner. It fucking worked. Peter Corbeau cured Bruce Banner of the Hulk affliction, but the sun is now flaring with more radiation than expected. And it turns out the sun might wipe out life on Earth unless Bruce gives up being the Hulk. So Peter sends him to relax on the beach while they investigate. Jarella, that green skin girl that Hulk once thought Lorna Dane was her, which is hilarious. It's his little princess girlfriend from the Microverse, shows up, and Corbeau realizes that the magic that was used to bring Jarella to Earth is what has made the sun unstable, and now it might blow up, but he feels it's unjust to send Jarella back to her homeworld because she might die there. So he plans to send an LM D instead, and it's gotta like weigh the same amount as her, so we could like displace the mass. But there's an assassin named Fialin who's there to kill Jarella from her homeworld. To save lives, Bruce Banner ends up turning himself back into the Hulk. The life model decoy gets destroyed, the Hulk gets tranked, Jarella has to be sent back to the Microverse. The cure worked, but it failed, but now the sun is stabilized, and that is the fucking introduction of Peter Corbeau. There's a lot to unpack in this story, and this is his most dense story out of all of them, I think.
What you said, like this being his most dense story, I think the fact that he said those things about knowing Bruce in college is like the most background we get on him ever about his younger days. And then just to have like that whole whole, like the chaos of Jarella, after it was all said and done, it's a shame he didn't go back and revisit the situation or like try to learn from that and adapt, because you said he did cure the Hulk. So there's potential there. So it seems like that's a, 60 years later, it could be a plot point to follow up on him, but he got sideswiped in X-Men.
There's this moment where Peter Corbeau is like steps onto the scene. He is so self-confident. And I have seen that scientist in the room before. I felt like that scientist in the room before at times, where you're just like, I know what I'm talking about. I know where we're going with this project. Here's what I'm gonna lay out. He's self-confident. Things go terribly wrong, and he makes the adjustments and makes it work. He doesn't seem to ever be sort of in a panic himself. And I think there's, something really admirable and incredible about that. It is super frustrating, I'm sure. And we don't really get this fallout, but I've been there as a scientist where things work the way you want them to, and it still fails. And that is incredibly frustrating as a scientist. In many ways, this is one of the things that is really frustrating about actually working on a problem like climate change, because the way that I feel like, the way that things go well is if I sort of work my way out of a job, right? Like, if everyone in the world knows that climate change is a problem and we're all working to stop it, then I probably can pack it up and go home. I hope that happens in my lifetime. I hope that we're working, towards these things. But there are always going to be these sort of problems that are looming that we have to work on together. And I think Peter Corbeau, faces this obstacle and he gets it right. He succeeds at his problem and then he has to give it all back. And that's incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, so one of the interesting components for this guy is he is able to gather resources relatively quickly. And he was right, right? He's working with the US military. He's got a plan. When I gave that mad thinker comparison a minute ago, he has the exact plan. He's calculated all the data. He's got the sun in the satellite and the energy receivers, and everything works perfectly. But the thing he can't predict is that this lady teleported to Earth from the microverse at that moment. Then he immediately recalibrates. Oh, let's send an LMD back. But, Banner sacrifices himself. It's a really interesting character development. And he's a likable character in this way. One of the many people to try to cure the Hulk, but one of the few to actually succeed. It's interesting, too, because the Hulk mythos has been explored so deeply. Gamma energy and the multiple personalities of Bruce Banner and how it connects to, like, the Eldritch dimension of the Green Door and the more recent stuff. So you almost wonder if Peter even knew, but there is so much continuity still to be added later, The other thing that's really powerfully introduced in the beginning, which is kind of a Marvel staple, but again, never widely explored, is the idea of StarCorps.
The only thing I could get out of StarCorps is it seems like it's a group of astronauts, and in some cases it's like an international collection of astronauts that are just monitoring the sun, and they focus solely on the sun.
I think they're taking a lot of data, but it's primarily the sun, absolutely.
Reminds me a little bit of the sun station in All-Star Superman, if I can step a little bit outside the Marvel universe for a second. There are these like group of scientists that are clearly working together. I don't think we ever do we ever learn what StarCorps means?
No, there's one issue of Iron Man, I think, where there's a bunch of periods put in, like it's an acronym, but
So
mostly it's
it
just
is an
called
acronym.
StarCorps. Well, there's only one spot where it's alluded. But we get StarCorps 1, we get StarCorps Command, we get StarCorps Stark, we get StarCorps Station, we get Project StarCorps, we get StarCorps with acronyms in the middle. You never quite know exactly,
But it is a division of NASA, right? Like it's part of their.
Sometimes it's NASA, sometimes it's the United Nations, sometimes it's Stark International.
And I know at different times he was calling for S.H.I.E.L.D.
There's a
that.
lot of stuff in the early 70s too where things were direct parallels of what was happening in the real world. I do not know if StarCorps was something that exists in the real world in some sort of capacity, but this is 1972, which is only 3 years after man landed on the moon. So let's jump to Avengers 102. This is an issue we've reviewed on my show. This is where the son of Bolivar Trask is back and the Avengers fight the Sentinels in the Australian outback. And this is where the Sentinels are trying to cause a solar flare that will wipe out all humans and make them sterile and thus, destroy all mutants, which is their primary programming. If you remember, Cyclops sent them flying into the sun one time and then they came back mutated, or at least Sentinel number two did. So in Avengers 102, this is a Roy Thomas story. We get the quote, StarCorps 1 is a sun watch station, paid for, launched, and manned under the auspices of the United Nations, spinning endlessly precisely midway between Earth and Venus, it is the life's dream of one Peter Corbeau, designed by him to scan it, to find out what makes it tick. It's also quite good at crying wolf. And we see some people here, they're later given names, but this is Dimitri and Hillary. They see the massive sentinels leave the sun's orbit and head to Earth. Corbeau warns the Avengers, something's wrong with the sun, fatally wrong. Some outside force is trying to provoke a nova force resonance pattern in the sun's energy field. In short, trying either to blow it up or cause it a solar flare of fantastic intensity. Already it's induced flares which shoot several million miles out into space, though none powerful enough to harm the Earth yet. And he's tracked it to the Australian desert. Every hour on the hour, a new flare is evoked. And the next one could be the one which might eradicate virtually all organic life on Earth. And welcome to the first of Peter Corbeau's cat-like cameos where he gets to explain sun science to Marvel superheroes.
So the sun is an incredibly important part of the climate system. In effect, we wouldn't be here, obviously, without the sun. And we wouldn't have weather without the sun. We have weather primarily because the Earth is trying to move around extra bits of energy and some parts of it to the parts of the planet that have less energy. The energy is trying to sort of balance itself out. And where are we getting all that extra energy? We're getting it from the sun. So the weather on our planet and the climate systems that set up, which are basically just the long-term effects of weather over time, those are related to the sun as well. But when we're talking about climate change, that is, you know, human-caused climate change, which is the increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that is really an earthbound effect. It is what we call a terrestrial effect, where it's really this long-wave, earth-based radiation that is really being captured by the carbon dioxide we're increasing in the atmosphere. So when it comes to the long-term changes of our climate system, on the human timescales that we care about, the sun changes are not actually playing that big of a role.
And it's also about the delicate balance, right? We have to have that perfect distance from the sun, the right amount of protection from it. If we're a degree higher or a degree lower, everything changes. And with global warming, there's obviously major impacts of our own climate raising and the devastating potential impacts of that. In our very short lifetimes, we've seen a number of changes already happen, and the sun plays a big part in that. So Peter gets to call out the watch cry this repeatedly in the early 1970s.
Sometimes that must be kind of like a cool job to have too, right? Like the Paul Revere of solar flares. So
I love that. I hope that's on his business cards. Like, I've won 2 Nobel Prizes and I'm the Paul Revere of solar flares.
So apparently in 1972, I just looked this up, there was a major solar flare event that August. And that makes total sense to me that Claremont is looking at the news and he sees this solar flare event and you know, has the idea to throw it at
well, and Roy Thomas, too, because the yeah. Roy Thomas had the Sentinels doing the solar flare thing, right? I've thrown myself into the world of like movies and music in 1972, but I've certainly not studied science. Now, we next see Corbeau again back in Incredible Hulk number 172. There's a guy named Colonel John Armbruster. We reviewed this episode on my show as well because of the Juggernaut appearance, but there's some really fun energy. Armbruster is a guy that's trying to like take the nonsense that is Thunderbolt Ross and actually do stuff against the Hulk correctly, and everybody's so fucking pissed at him. This, we talk about him a little bit on the show. There's a long interchange between Armbruster and Corbeau. Will you guys read this section of dialogue? Derek, will you play John Armbruster, and Daniel, will you play Peter Corbeau here?
I've heard a lot about you, Dr. Corbeau, inventor of Star Corps 1, Nobel Prize winner, and I believe you gave some help to Hulkbuster base once, didn't you? Well, you'll be glad to know the Hulk problem is finally solved.
There is a Hulk problem, Colonel Armbruster? You've caused it with your incredibly ignorant policies. I'm coming to Hulkbuster base immediately to see if I can fix up the disaster that you created.
Fuck you, Armbruster.
On whose authority, Mr. Corbeau?
The White House's, Colonel. And in case you're wondering, they don't like me any better than you do. They do like the benefit they derive from Star Corps 1.
Okay, so he's in love with Bruce Banner, right? So Corbeau arrives on the base and the conflict continues and the Hulk is pounding on his cage and literally shaking the ground. And he's supposed to be sedated, but like Armbruster miscalculated how much it would take to keep the Hulk sedated. So we keep going here.
So Corbeau says, considering the number of complaints that you sent the Pentagon over my coming here, Colonel, I'm surprised you're personally escorting me around.
My opposition to your presence here is on on record, Dr. Corbeau, but I follow orders.
I'll see that you get on the dean's list. You boys wouldn't be using rubber hoses on the Hulk, would they, Colonel? And soon, good lord, men, the creature's on the verge of insanity, thanks to you. And judging from the blows, he will break free. We don't have much more than a few hours now, Colonel. What we'll have to do is exile the Hulk into a limbo-like dimension, using a new space-time warp that I'm experimenting on. If
just
it
in
works
his spare
for you.
time, you know.
Yeah. Space-time warp. Yeah, just that's a Tuesday for me. If it works, we'll be able to bring the Hulk back whenever we can cure him. If not, he'll be trapped in that dimension for all eternity.
So he sets up this big old machine, and he and Armbruster are the ones to put themselves at risk in order to activate it. And Peter says,
"You've got guts, Armbruster. I'll give you that."
"Likewise, mister."
And then they zap the Hulk away, and Peter thinks,
"Forgive me, old friend. I just hope I haven't exiled the Hulk permanently, and with him, Bruce Banner."
So Armbruster's smoking a pipe, and he touches Peter on the shoulder, says,
"Your machine worked fine, Dr. Corbeau."
"Colonel, kindly take your compliments and cram them up your..."
SST, which is an acronym for Safe Secure Transport. And
pretty,
John says,
"Pretty easy to blame everything on the military, isn't it? I guess we make good scapegoats, always have. But while you're making your clever insults and scoring verbal points, you might consider, what the blazes?"
And suddenly, because you can't predict shit, Juggernaut shows up. He's been floating in another dimension, and he comes back and he breaks out, and he and the Hulk smash through some shit, and you know, Corbo's gone from there. But Corbeau gets called back in to help the Hulk again. The romantic intonations of just like the queerness of these three characters, Corbeau toward the Hulk and Armbruster toward Corbeau, is really interesting when you read this issue. It's subtle, but it feels relevant to me. I don't know what your thoughts are there.
So I knew you were going to go there with this, but
I always do.
What I really like about Corbeau, and I didn't say this in the beginning, again, he's one of these scientists that actually has like a moral, has morals. So I think he just generally cares about the person. And I don't know if it's a romantic caring, but like, I think he's shown in many instances where he actually cares about people that, and has that empathy instead of just being like narcissistic and trying to innovate and be fantastic.
He's probably not queer, but it's still fun to read it that way.
But Chad, he might live on an alpaca farm with his husband and have 16 kids. Like, I don't, there's a whole backstory we don't know about him. So,
but I don't think
that, I'm sure you've written it. So.
Yeah, I don't, I think it's a genuine relationship that he just has, thinking good, you know, has good feelings towards a friend, an old friend from college. I don't think that it's more than that in this particular case, but I absolutely think, you know, what could be happening off on his any number of private islands, which he certainly shares.
We don't often see Corbeau lose his shit, but there's something about somebody who doesn't think things through. He has very little patience for that, right? Like, I think that's what makes him so frustrated with this guy.
He does send Hulk to his own private island, like off the coast, to rejuvenate. I mean, is he gonna go check up on him? There is like a romantic like relationship that happens between Hulk and his paramour, like during that entire time. I don't know. Maybe there's something there.
But he also has a satellite and a private island. So.
That's right. So, he has many private islands. I'm certain of this.
We will be doing this next three issues on my show as script readings later this year. X-Men 98 through 100 is the infamous story, maybe Marvel Comics' most famous story, the initial part of the Phoenix Saga. This is where Stephen Lang has built Project Armageddon on a satellite up in space, and he's designed some Sentinels to look like the old X-Men, and he's fucking crazy, and he wants to kill all mutants. Charles Xavier in X-Men 98 is on vacation, and he's fishing aboard a boat named for the Princess of Mars, the book by Edgar Rice Burroughs. Her name is Deja Thoris. So Peter has a boat named after Deja Thoris, which is cute. The boat gets destroyed, and he later has another boat called the Deja Thoris 2. So he's really obsessed with this particular character, which I think is really fun. This is where we first see him in his little sailor cap. And
He's on vacation again with another man on a private island.
Another billionaire queer-coded. And this is where he's looking real good. He's got his little sailor cap. He's got his little tight black shirt on. He's got a little pipe. And the caption tells us that he won the Nobel Prize twice, but we don't know what for ever. It's literally never told us what for. And Charles has been having some nightmares of an alien princess.
I don't know, Charles. If I didn't know you better, I'd figure it's some sort of practical joke. I mean, the binary star system you described isn't Miserae or Alcivor Prime or Dusanane. Face it, Charles. Star Corps charted over half the Milky Way galaxy, and your binary isn't anywhere to be found.
Your alien princess doesn't exist, Charles.
Are you sure, Peter? You must have missed something.
You mean know me better than that? I checked the program a dozen times. Blazes, man. I even ran a query through the Fantastic Four and Avengers charts. The result was the same. Nothing. Charles, look, you've been under a hell of a strain lately. More than any man could rightly stand. It could be that this binary star of yours isn't real at all. It could be all in your mind, and I think you should seek professional help.
I love that this man can tell Charles to get therapy. It makes me happy. But this is a thing we see with Professor X and so many characters. He's got these bonds with these people all over the world, and one of them is with Peter Corbeau. We know Xavier runs like a human underground, like of mutant allies, and I almost feel like Peter's like someone, somewhere along the way, there's some story where he recruited Peter to this, and they've been friends ever since. A sentinel fucking rises out of the water. Charles knocks it over with a mental blast because somehow he can do that with sentinels. It's never been explained, but it happens all the time. And Peter pilots the ship out of there, and he yells,
You've given us time, Charles, and with this little hydrofoil of mine, time is all we need. I designed this little baby myself. There's nothing afloat that can catch her when she's running, and right now she's running fine. Do me a favor, though. Watch out for our tin playmate while I call in the Air Force.
Charles is overcome by another nightmare of Lilandra, and it startles Peter. Lord, that scream, he yells. The poor sod's gone totally round the bend. There's another sentinel bursts right through the ship. It destroys the Dejah Thoris. Oh no.
No.
Captures Xavier, and Corbeau is left stranded at sea, saying,
Looks bad, chum. You're 200 miles from land. If no one heard your mayday, it's gonna be one long swim.
So he's bragging about his little boat, then he has to cling to the wreckage in the water. In X-Men 99, Sentinels capture more of the X-Men, and Corbeau helps the remaining mutant heroes track the Sentinel alloys into space by using Xavier's computers, which he has a familiarity with, and discovering a connection to NORAD's Valhalla base. He says, I never
Okay, yeah, go
dreamed
ahead.
Xavier had that kind of clearance. And it turns out that Stephen Lang and his Project Armageddon plan have him waging war on mutants from a space station. So Corbeau joins the X-Men. He's wearing a very snug white uniform. They're headed into space for a rescue mission. Corbeau sees Cyclops lose his mind in desperation to gain control over the team. He sees Lang launch the X-Sentinels. And in 100, he's captured. He's in the stasis tube. In the subsequent fight, when he breaks out, he helps carry a unconscious Professor X to safety. The X-Men load him up into the escape craft. Cyclops says, The fire's almost reached the hyperjolic fuel cells, Dr. Corbeau. We haven't much time. And he says,
Wrong, Cyclops. We have all the time in the world because we're sure not going anywhere. At least in this crate, the flight control computers must have been slagged during our little fracas with the Sentinels. And without it, we're as good as finished.
And Derek, will you give us Wolverine here?
What about a manual re-entry?
Oh no, you gotta, you, what about a man? You gotta give us Wolverine.
What about a manual re-entry?
What about it? What about it, Wolverine? In case you hadn't noticed, we got a thumping great hole in the shuttle's hull. And thanks again to the Sentinels, no functional pressure suits. But that's the least of our problems.
Nightcrawler says, Ich werse'n, Herr Doctor, the solar flare. Sorry, Kevin.
Got it, Nightcrawler. The worst flare in years. The computer was supposed to fly us out of here while we sat safe and sound in the shuttle's shielded life cell. Only we've no computer. Sure, I can fly a re-entry, no sweat, but I wouldn't last 30 seconds in that flare. One of you might survive the flare, but you can't pilot the shuttle. We need someone who can do both, and there's no such animal.
Wrong, Dr. Corbeau. I can do both. Are you crazy, Jean? Since when are you a qualified astronaut? Since now. Hold still, Doctor. This will only hurt a little. I'm a telepath, Scott. Remember? I can absorb all Dr. Corbeau knows about flying the space shuttle. I won't be a great pilot, but I'll be good enough to get us down. And Jean has to knock Cyclops out in order to do this. So Corbeau is fucking on the ship when it crashes into Jamaica Bay, and Jean pops out as the Phoenix. And good Lord, that's a lot to handle. So he and his friend Dr. McKay give Jean the once over, and they're like, she's fine. Turns out that's not. Okay. So the crazy fun fact, this is a character that's involved in the Dark Phoenix storyline.
As we go through his like chronological or his appearances here, he's in a lot of really important, he's cameo in a lot of really important Marvel milestones. You know, he's not a superhero and doesn't have any superpowers, but the thing that really stood out for me after the boat crash is he swam 200 miles to shore.
Unless there was a distress like ship that
Unless there
showed
were,
up.
yeah, but it showed, he like appears in the backyard of the X-Men, like covered in water there in the mansion, like just out of the wreckage. So it seemed the way it's portrayed is very superheroic. Otherwise, I really enjoy that he has a connection to Binary and Captain Marvel too eventually. So that's kind of fun too. I was actually going back and rereading this. I totally forgot he was a part of it all. So thanks for calling him out.
Life is a workout. and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
For me.
Another solar flare thing, right? But he's the guy that is able to calculate everything. This is what we need to survive. And Gene downloads that intel from his brain in order to make sure that they get there, which is crazy. That's a really fun piece of this story. It's his knowledge that allowed her to pilot the ship. This is his most famous appearance. Obviously, it's captured in the cartoon later.
That's right. The fact that he's in these moments to me is really exciting. He's the only not super powered character in these moments. And that puts him in this unique position where he is particularly vulnerable, but he's not panicking when he's explaining what's going on when the ship goes down. When he's about to go off into space, actually, if I can just read one line from from 99, so Uncanny 99, there's this countdown fight, which is one of my favorite panels in all of comics, in fact, where there's this great liftoff of the space shuttle from Cape Canaveral, where there's a 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and you get thoughts from each of the X characters. But the very first character that you get a thought from is Peter Corbeau, and he thinks to himself, 5 seconds and here I go again, away from Mother Earth and into the deadliest environment known to man. So why do I feel like I'm going?
Oh,
and
he loves outer space.
That is Peter Corbeau, that spirit of adventure into danger. He is with the X-Men, I think, because he is an X-Man. He is embodying that aspect of the X-Men that I love so much, which is the willingness, you know, very much actually like Wolverine, this willingness to put himself on the line in search of something greater, whether that be protecting his friends in this particular case, or just the spirit of adventure that I think he's embodying here. I find him very inspirational.
Daniel, you mentioned at the start like how the hurricane inspired you. I love the idea of Peter Corbeau reading fiction as a kid, sci-fi, and like getting this idea about Dejah Thoris and like this world out there, and that's like inspired his like long journey through all of this. So Ms. Marvel number 6, this is another Claremont story. We get a flashback to years ago where Carol Danvers is in the Air Force. She goes to Houston's Lunar Receiving Laboratory, and Dr. Peter Corbeau is working on the Cavorite crystal. Basically, the crystal is a high-range energy matrix. Pour power into it, and it seems to warp the space around it. In theory, pour enough power into it while focusing and refining the matrix flow, and presto, we have a potential faster-than-light star drive. Unfortunately, if we make the slightest mistake, the backlash will probably destroy the world. And Ms. Marvel fights Grotesque, who gets the Cavorite crystal. This is the guy who killed the changeling in Professor X's form. I have a Patreon episode on Grotesque. But this is another plot device for Peter, who pops in for a panel or two to explain the science. And then he's like Clippy. He's like Clippy in Microsoft Word. Peter shows up, a little cartoon avatar that tells you what's going on.
You look like you're trying to fight with Grotesque.
I'm going to cover a bunch of stuff all at once, and then let's pause. We'll do about 5 at a time here. In Avengers Annual 7, StarCore is what informs the Avengers about Thanos' space armada approaching Earth. We jump to X-Men 107, where the McCrane crystal blinks and all of reality starts to blip out. And Corbeau's like, what the fuck? Everything ended for like a second. And he turns to like Mr. Fantastic. In 108, he's frantically delivering the news to President Jimmy Carter. Rest in peace, President Carter. The FF and the Avengers. We registered a total disruption of the nuclear and gravimetric lines of force that bind all matter together. And if this disruption should occur again, ladies and gents, we could very well be witnessing the end of our universe as we know it and live in it. 135, Corbeau's in space, the Dark Phoenix rushes by and he tries to analyze the data of it and was like, oh, I don't know what happened. That went by too fast. In 136, he's panicking on the screen because Dark Phoenix has ended a planet.
This puts him on the, basically on par with the Shi'ar in terms of his like understanding of what's happening with Dark Phoenix. Like he's analyzing what's going on. He's seeing that there's this major threat. I mean, this is what the Shi'ar are doing, but I just find this like incredible. Like he is at a very high level in sort of the Marvel universe when it comes to space technology, in my opinion.
Yeah, this man, UN connections, presidential connections, military connections, hero connections. He's on a first name basis with Reed Richards and Bruce Banner. Like he knows everybody.
And Jimmy Carter.
Yeah. I love when they use the real president. We jump to X-Men 150. He's got the Dejah Thoris 2 now. And the caption tells tells us, Peter Corbo, astronaut, physicist, engineer, creator of the StarCorm manned orbital solar laboratory, and most importantly, friend. And he's playing host to Xavier and Moira McTaggart and Carol Danvers. And I kind of get the vibe that these two are fucking here. So maybe he's bisexual or, you know, whatever. And he's wearing his little sailor cap. And Xavier's out in the ocean looking for Scott Summers, who's been deserted on an island with Lee Forrester. This is Magneto's like magic island that he raised from the seafloor. Corbo thinks they should look in the Bermuda Triangle. And sure enough, the X-Men are there. And there's a battle with Magneto. And Corbo gets to help them save the day. And in 154, he's still on the island prepping the ship with Colossus, and in 158 he's still there, and Carol Danvers is training with the Starjammers, and he takes a reading on her fighting skills because she lost her powers, and she still has some superhuman alterations, which later turns her into binary.
It's cool to see him hanging out with a bunch of superheroes, like it's all natural. So It just shows how comfortable he is with the adventuring lifestyle and just what that all leads to. And like I said before, I after going through everything, I really want to see him follow up with Carol Danvers, and like I think he could be. I'm shocked hasn't been any Captain Marvel runs since this. So
she ran like the Alpha Flight space station for a long time. Like that's a really easy place for Corbo to have showed up, right? Like it's literally monitoring the Earth. He could have connections to Abigail Brand and S.W.O.R.D. There's so many places he could fit.
He made a cameo in Avengers West Coast Annual 5, and it was broken up into many parts, but he was basically a talking head on a news, basically on like a 24-hour news channel.
He's on Nightline.
Yeah. So it was him, a senator, and I forget the senator's name, and a UFO, a guy who owns a UFO hostel.
It wasn't a senator. It's a guy named William Quintana, who is described as the associate to the managing co-director's assistant on the vice president's task force on extraterrestrial events, which is amazing.
I can't believe I forgot that title. But so they were all being interviewed, and Terminus, who is an alien, is on the planet. And I that story was kind of convoluted to me, but like had a son and then one ate the other one and got superpowered. But
Terminus is a lot to process.
Right. He's playing like the science, grounded in science guy. And you see these debates play out like in the real world today, where they have a scientist on there, but then there's a political aspect to it. And then there's like the other extreme of this guy who owns a UFO hostel from Wisconsin. I love how they made him from the Midwest. And so they're all just trying to have a debate. And then there's a lot of crosstalk and he gets frustrated.
Yeah, he's just a little talking head. It's kind of a fun appearance for him. Yeah. Actually, maybe one of my favorites. If I'm honest, it's cute. And then he's back in Avengers 344, 345.
Yeah, so he's on StarCorps 1. It looks like he was around the orbit of Mercury with a crew. These people, Mikhail and Talia. So I don't know Talia. And Mikhail is not the same Mikhail that we're used to from later in X-Men, right?
Oh, no. It's not Colossus's brother. But yeah. These are Marvel characters. One is Mikhail Kutuzov, and the other is Talia Kruma. They go look them up on the Marvel appendix. They have brief histories in the Marvel universe. Not extensive at all.
So he has another sort of moment where he's like, good Lord, the sun's entire electromagnetic field has been snapping back and forth like a rubber band. And I'm starting to realize now, does he have like some catchphrases like good Lord and blazes and things like that? I feel like he's come with these a few times that I'm starting to pick up.
There's another, yeah, like solar flare thing. There's a really fun issue of Quasar where Quasar like scoops all this like dark sunspot energy off the sun with his like negaband. And like Corbo's like supervising. It's an interesting, there's another issue where like Captain Marvel saves the sun too. There's some really interesting stories where it gets really high science-y. Iron Man 314 seems to set up a new era for Iron Man that never really gets followed up on. And Corbo's here, Tony Stark has rebranded his company and he's like somehow finagled getting the UN contract backing StarCorps, which is defined as the United Nations Space Agency here. And there's a meeting with Corbo. He says, after that Galactic Storm business a while back destroyed our original space platform, the United Nations started to see the national security benefits of a robust space program. After he read my proposals, the Secretary General did tell me I was asking for the moon. I replied, what makes you think I'll settle for the moon? And in 319, Corbeau publicly announces that Stark has won the contract for StarCorps, the command satellite, and Henry Peter Gyrick is his United Nations liaison. Stay tuned for the inevitable trial of Henry Peter Gyrick on my show someday. But he has no idea Stark's kind of manipulating him and thinks of Corbeau as an easy mark. So this guy gets along with everybody, but fuck Iron Man. But then the crossing happens. We're not going to worry about it. So there's some stuff set up that's never really followed up on.
Sometimes Iron Man comics, really interesting take on capitalism and how all that works. So it would have been cool to see that play out, especially how, the capitalist structure that we are all working in for the most part, like contributes to things like climate change or extractive economies and all that. So it could have been cool to see how Corbeau's moral compass kind of fell in line with all of that.
That's right. I think that's the most interesting part is like, how is he playing into this system when he's interacting with Tony Stark? Like, how is he thinking about all of that money and all of those resources and all of that influence and that opportunity? How is he using it? I would have loved to have seen more in this space so I could kind of understand, the ethical choices that he's having to make, what inspiration we can draw from how he's navigating that, because I'm sure it's incredibly complex. It remains very complex in our ecosystem. We're trying to figure out, how do we move forward as a species working on a problem like climate change is incredibly complex because there are so many values, there are so many people that are vulnerable, there are so many opportunities for growth ahead of us as well. And there will be winners and there will be losers. And it's difficult, to figure out what decisions to make to be most equitable. Even if we were all on the same page about what equitable meant, it would still be difficult. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done in this space. And I would love myself personally to have more inspiration for that. And so I feel like there's a bit of a missed opportunity here.
So approximately 100 years ago, I did an academic panel on my show about Cerebro, and we talked about this story. Cerebro goes sentient for a while and creates a team of fake X-Men, and he calls himself the Founder, and he poses as Xavier, and he's trying to hijack a controversial rocket called the Benassi rocket that's being launched by the government to catalog mutants, but he wants to use it to like sterilize the planet or something. And he questions Corbeau, who quickly realizes this is not Xavier, and then Kitty Pryde saves Corbeau and protects him from the fake X-Men. And I'm really proud of myself for keeping that so simple because it's one of the most annoying stories in Marvel's history. I really hate it. I mean, it's good, I understand, but it's a pile. We jump to X-Man 55, where we see Corbeau send a distress call because a Shi'ar Stargate is opening and something's passing through. Again, he's there to sound the clarion call. He's back in X-Men 100 because one time the High Evolutionary, who also has a trial on my show, launched a satellite that ended up depowering mutants for a minute. So now Corbeau's up there with the X-Men trying to repurpose the satellite. Maybe we can do something good with it, but humans want it destroyed and he's determined like he can use it. And in a key moment, Corbeau reminds the mutants, Charles Xavier founded the X-Men as an expression of hope. And then the Neo attack, which is an evolutionary offshoot of people who have powers but aren't mutants. The X-Men have to flee with Corbeau against impossible odds. And there's another space adventure for Corbeau with the X-Men that involves the Neo. Guys, I just covered the Neo, the Founder, the fake X-Men in like 30 seconds. I'm really proud of myself.
Doing
I
great.
did. I did not get this far in the reading, I have to admit. It is dense.
Continuity goes crazy for a while.
Two things. One, and that in the Founder story, like the image of seeing Pierre Corbeau when he's shown, when Kitty finds him, is kind of jarring because he's panicking, he's like tied up, he's like stressed out, and then it's never followed. Like Kitty rescues him and has never followed up on like how he's doing or where he is or how where he ended up. So that was like another. I feel like I've been saying a lot of like there's a lot of loose tangents with this guy, but I think that's just his jam. Like he's in and out. Like that's all we need to know about him.
He's a very consistent bit character. He serves a certain purpose, right? Except for the occasional big adventure, which is fun.
In 100, when I was rereading it, the landing of the shuttle or the spacecraft was very similar. And he makes reference to, like, oh, I've done this before, except I'm awake this time. So he references, like, the Phoenix Saga in this
Yeah,
landing.
super cool.
So that was a really cool callback. And then the X-Men not say, like, so the X-Men are disguised themselves and they're off. They don't land with the rest of the crew. And they say, oh, Dr. Corbeau is an ally. He will cover for the X. Again, shows what a good ally, I guess, he is and how excited he is to be part of these adventures.
So I'll cover the rest very quickly. And again, listen to his position here. Maximum security happens, which is where a bunch of aliens are like, let's go throw all of our worst criminals on Earth, which is what Trump says other countries are doing. This is where they like lock the planet up and toss Ego, the living planet, on to like, it's a crazy story. It's fun though. It's a fun one. So Earth is a prison colony and Corbeau calls the Avengers from space. He's like, a force shield's been put up around the planet. In Uncanny Avengers 7, Genocide, the son of Apocalypse and Famine the Horseman, who's a character I really want to do a Patreon on sometime soon. Like, he uses the Starcore station to send out like an edict to the universe. In a title called Indomitable Iron Man number 1, there's a NASA probe that's endangered, so Corbo calls Iron Man to help save it. In Captain America and the Mighty Avengers 8, the incursions are happening. This is where alternate reality Earths are lining up with our own, and only one can survive, and it leads into the Secret Wars by Jonathan Hickman. It's delightful sci-fi. Corbo makes a statement about the science behind it on the news, and he has a sailor's cap on here, and he's called Dr. Peter Corbo, scientist, adventurer. We also get him more recently in X-Men Red number 16 and 17, where he's still in his sailor cap, and he's delivering weaponless Zen and Bucky O'Hare and the really gay Prince of Power character from Guardians of the Galaxy and some mutant refugees to Araco. Craig Marshall, who's Storm's new boyfriend, is there. The war breaks out. They have to redirect back to the peak, but they go back to Araco. And then X-Men Marvel Snapshots. This is where Jay Edidin actually gets to write Peter Corbo for one issue on like one page. Derek, do you want to tell us about this one? It's cute.
Yeah, Scott attends like Reed Richards, Tony Stark, and Peter Corbo are presenting like their research in Omaha, and Scott shows up and listens.
This is like little baby Scott, like from the orphanage.
Yeah. And he like, I think Corbo, there's like two sentences. They just show him speaking, orating on stage, or doing like his TED talk on stage. And then some villain, the Mantis, I think. Dr. Mantis.
Yeah, Linda. Her name's Linda.
Attacks and
is this different from the Mantis?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Attacks. Or this non-Mantis.
This is a lady who just shows up one time. We in my Locust episode, we talk about how we want her and Locust to go on a date sometime. She's cute. She's giving very Edna Mode vibes.
There's a lot of potential there for sure.
So I think a lot of the potential of this character shows up in his consistent bits: the sailor cap, the ship, the sci-fi, the sun flares. But a lot of what we really need to love this character and to make him really integral are some of the things that fill in the holes. What are the things, as we're finishing our conversation, that really stand out as the glaring things that you want to know about Peter Corbo that would make this character more integral or beloved to readers?
I want to know if he is alone or if he has someone that he comes home to at the end of the day. I think both are okay and interesting in their own ways. If he was alone, I can imagine that being like kind of a commitment of his, like, I'm going to go out into space. That's where I live. That's where I adventure. And it's challenging sometimes to like, when you're out there doing your work, you know, in the field, to have a family back home. And maybe he doesn't want that. We don't really see him attached to anyone. It seems like he has a lot of deep friendships, but never has.
In the Avengers movies, there's that scene like 4 or 5 movies in where Hawkeye goes home and he's got like a really pretty wife and kids at home. I love that.
Yes.
That would be really cute.
Yes, I would love to see that. But it's going to be on a private island somewhere or some, you know, coastal North Carolina.
Derek, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I guess I feel the same way, but not necessarily that he has someone, but I want to know what his thing is. So like, what I mean by that is like, what's motivating? Where does his moral compass come from? Is it something in his upbringing? Is it something he's doing currently? I say that because, not to like be a downer, but I'm alone, but I'm still working in climate justice and climate at work. Like, so I don't have a family. Yeah. Like, I have a family, but not an immediate family. I don't have kids. I'm just fighting because it's the right thing to do in some of my upbringing. So I want to know what drives him to do the work. He doesn't have to be with anybody, and that's fine. But you think him and Carol are fucking? I've been sitting here for the past hour thinking about it, and like, I want to hear more about that. That's where I'm very interested.
I think this character is really interesting. The thing I'm most curious about is his connection to Xavier. I think there's some stuff that's really interesting to explore. I already shared my ideas of him like reading sci-fi as a kid, and like, we get just some of those moments that show him as the wide-eyed kid that dreams big, you know? But this character could fit in any Hulk title, in any Captain Marvel title, in any Iron Man title, and in any X-Men title. Again, we mentioned he could fit into S.W.O.R.D., he could fit into X-Men Red. There's a way for him to become a more prominent and consistent character, where even just playing him off of other characters as the reasonable scientist, or even a story where he finally makes the mistake. He falls for the wrong person, or he gets hoodwinked into something, or he trusts the wrong thing. Like, I think the science and the way it shows up and how he doesn't quite get it right always, but he always adapts. He's connected to so many huge Marvel stories. Again, from the Phoenix Force to the Emkron Crystal to the Incursions to Maximum Security, right? There's so many pieces of this that like really fall in. And he's one of those few guys that doesn't seem overwhelmed by magic or the stuff that's like the fucking building blocks of the universe. When the Emkron Crystal blinks and he's the guy that notices, he has to tell Reed Richards about it, you know? I think there's something about him that's really interesting. I also want to know what he fucking got his Nobel Peace Prizes for. They keep talking about him.
I think it would be great to see him just not permanently, but like do a stint in the Nova Corps. Like just have him actually have superpowered adventures so he knows what that what it's like to be to have the power that his friends all have. Again, not permanently, because I think he's much better as a just a normal human, but like just it'd be cool to see him like flying around in space.
Peter Corbeau hanging out with Richard Rydder is really fun, actually. I think that's a
I want
great
them as
combination.
roommates in space.
Yeah, that's actually really fun. And
Like it's a sitcom.
I love the idea of him and Carol Danvers being like casual fuck buddies, sort of like Wolverine and Storm are in their way. I think there's a lot of potential for this guy. I think he's really interesting. It's also very easy for him to get in over his head, right? Like there's so many, again, Thanos is coming to Earth, right? Like there's so many stories. I like this guy. I had to decide as we're talking, but I'm really fond of this guy. I'd love to hear any final thoughts that either of you have. How are you feeling? And is there anything you want to share with listeners about climate science and what you are currently working on and most passionate about as we begin 2025?
One final comment on Peter. I am very fond of the character now. I know what his role is. I think people like that in our world are very important and play that role. And I think, and I'll let Daniel talk more about this too. For decades, climate scientists were ignored. And I feel like Peter is this opportunity to like shine light on that and how the science community actually kind of can be portrayed or manipulated, not manipulated, it's not the wrong word, but like their value add to the political conversation too. I will also say in the cartoon on season three, when Eric the Red
That fucking guy.
and enters, he knows who Dr. Corbeau is. He doesn't know who the X-Men are. He's like, they're stowaways. So like that in the cartoon, Dr. Corbeau is more famous than the X-Men. So I thought that was pretty interesting too. And in regards to things to plug, I would just say get involved locally. It doesn't even matter if you have any interest in the environment or climate. There's also it's social justice is connected to climate. We're all connected. Extractive economies, capitalism, patriarchy, white supremacy, it's all caused the issues that we are all facing as in the world. So just get involved locally. I know, especially with a new federal administration, personally, I've been really focusing on my local community and what I can do and the vulnerable people in it. So ground yourself in that for the next 4 years. And
Dr. Peter Corbeau, I think he really represents this incredible spirit. I would love to know how he got involved with Charles Xavier. I feel like their friendship runs deep, and I feel like he is a person that, you know, it's called out in that moment. And I think the reason he, you know, is doing this, pushing forward, working so hard is, you know, for these friendships, even if many, many times he's just kind of this voice on a screen who is telling his friends to, you know, to look out. Sometimes that's a really important role to play. We live in a world that is going to be, you know, going to have its challenges going forward. I take hope from the many people around me that are wonderful and constantly working to make the world a better place, to make the world a more equitable place. But there's still a lot of work to be done. Many people ask me, what can you do or what can I do to address climate change? It feels like such a big problem, and it is an enormous problem, and it will take all of us. But guess what? It will take all of us. So take it one day at a time. It will take a long time, and have conversation. Many, many people believe that climate change is a problem and the environment is getting worse, and we're dealing with, you know, crises day after day. Many people are feeling this stress. Not many people are talking with their neighbors about it. That is the big disconnect. And the more conversations we have about climate, you know, casual conversations in your faith-based community or your cafe or your local gym, you know, wherever you're spending time or space in your local comic book store, talk with people about climate change. Spread the news that this is a problem that we are working on together, and together we are going to solve it. it.
Excellent. I'll address the sociology piece and then we'll sign off. I've been a therapist for a long time. I'm 46 years old. I've got two teenage children. The world population has doubled in my lifetime, which is a crazy thing to consider. And, you know, when the pandemic hit, I was doing a lot of sessions about fatigue with people. We have like extreme fatigue, like the news moves at such a speed and it's delivered in such a way that it inspires. For a while, it was really, the news really focused on fostering outrage in people. But I think it's really focused on inspiring fatigue in people, because if we stop caring, then there's nothing to fight against. And the billionaires have become bigger trillionaires, you know, in the last few years. So we're living in a time after the Trump election, I think a lot of people just kind of gave up. We have a relationship with social media and the way news is delivered. And there's just kind of a general kind of hopelessness when it comes to the economy. Climate science feels overwhelming, so it's easier just to ignore it and hope that somebody's going to fix it sometime. But it is important to talk about, because we're living in an era where we don't have a choice. Like, we have to either feel overwhelmed and learn how to handle it, or we ignore it and hope it'll go away. But for those of us that have got kids, you know, I had a moment during the pandemic. My 13-year-old was then 9, where there was like some sort of astrological event. And like, we were outside looking, and it was like something that happens every 70 years. I don't even remember what it was, some comet or something. And the planets were lined up in a certain way. And my kid turned to me and was like, wow, so many crazy things have happened in my lifetime. The earthquake, the pandemic, you know, like, they're listing these things. And I never had that sense at the age of 9 of like, oh geez, the world's really stacking up on me. And I think our children are being raised in that, which is a crazy thing to consider. They're aware in a way that we can't put it off on them. We have to support them and work with them in order to make this happen. I loved this conversation today. I'm going to be chewing on it for a while, but I'm fond of this character. I'm extremely fond of both of you. And I love that we get to hang out more doing some script readings coming up. So delightful to have you both in my life. Thank you for hanging out this evening. Where can people find you both online? Is there anything you want to plug? Everybody can follow the show Gray Malkin _Lane on Instagram.
You can follow me, Derek J. Nichols, on Instagram. I have nothing really to plug, but I'm happy to talk about comics, climate, justice work.
Derek also posts lots of fun cosplay and thirst traps, so feel free to enjoy. And Daniel?
So I am Comics Extracts on Instagram. I don't post very often, sometimes to my story, but you're welcome to reach out to me with a message there. And in case you want to talk about the X-Men, climate change, making meaning of comic books, that's what I'm excited to talk about. So reach out to me there. And I want to shout out my stepwife, Cuckoos, who are some of my good friends in the X-Men community.
Including the wonderful Jenna Lee Saunders, who will be joining us as your wife, the Wasp, in our Avengers readings, which will also be delightful. So
I'm slightly terrified by how horrible of a person I have to be on those episodes.
Another complicated scientist. It's going to be fun. Truly, and this is from the bottom of my heart, having hung out with you both in person, you guys are just the loveliest, warmest, wonderful people. I'm really, truly glad to have you both in my life. Knowing the both of you and many people in this community has made my life better. So I can't wait to hang out again this year when we get to meet at various cons. And again, welcome back to my show again and again and again. Love hearing from you all the time, anytime. All right, everybody, thanks for listening. I hope you learned a lot and had some fun today. We will see you back here next time on the Gray Malkin Lane Patreon channel.
And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications. In 1933, the Nazi Party began sending literature to communities in America to try to draw local support. By 1936, the German-American Bund had formed, BUND, a group tasked with rebranding Hitler's teachings under the label of true Americanism, quote-unquote, pushing principles of pure blood and Aryanism. By 1939, 20,000 people attended the Bund rally at Madison Square Garden, and public speeches condemned Jews and communists both. But the crowd joined in the Nazi salute while calling out, quote, 100% Americanism. In other words, a weird version of America first. Let's jump to 1969. It's Captain America 115 through 118. John Buscema is on art here, along with Gene Colan. Stan Lee's the writer. The Cosmic Cube spit out of a volcano and into the hands of a man who tried using it for good, but the Red Skull stole it for himself. So after humiliating his allies and the exiles, he then went after Captain America, taunting the hero with his vast power, literally growing to giant size and pitching Cap across the universe, sort of, before trapping him in a bottle. When you got the Cosmic Cube, you can mess with shit, I guess. The Red Skull then took Captain America's form for, again, another time, while putting Captain America in
according to his own body, the greatest evil disguised as the, quote, all-American value system. While enjoying the adoration of the, quote, unthinking masses, while he was a, quote, hero, the Red Skull hoped that Cap would be defeated by his own allies in his own body. But instead, he trapped Cap on the Isle of the Exiles with the Nazi war criminals, and they attacked him. But we soon meet Sam Wilson, who's out there on Exile Island, training a falcon for fun. He has a bird named Redwing, and he's just out there kind of learning how to falcon. And he's discovered that the natives of the island have been forced to serve the Nazi exiles as, like, slaves in their own way. The lower class, you know, supporting the rich Nazi upper class. He costumes himself in green in time and soon calls himself the Falcon, and he leads an insurrection of the local tribes against the Nazi exiles, organizing his own uprising. Captain America soon figures out, oh, I can take the Red Skull mask off, because he didn't think of this before somehow, and he helps train Sam Wilson, the Falcon, to be a new superhero, even though the Falcon doesn't know he's Cap at first, because again, he's in the Red Skull's body. So anyway, the Red Skull ends up taking his own form back, and he summons Captain America and Falcon back before him in his castle, where he tells the Falcon that he is meant to be a slave, and in the end, the Red Skull is overwhelmed and kind of seems to melt out of existence with the Cosmic Cube. We'll see him back shortly, so stay tuned for next time. Let me welcome my dear friend Andre Mason to the show to talk about this crazy story with me. Andre, hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm actually kind of gagging over the fact that I forgot that the Cosmic Cube was shot out of a volcano. I just completely forgot that part. So
soap out of a fist. That's a phrase they always use.
Yeah, just like movies. just did it make a sound when it come out? Like what? I don't remember that. That's insane.
Are you a Red Skull fan?
I am, actually, only because I love the fact that he represents a very pure evil, a very clear villain with very clear, you know, intentions that makes him a pure bad guy 100%.
It's often forgotten that he's closely attuned to the origins of Sam Wilson, but this is the first appearance of the Falcon. Later, we get all the crazy Snap Wilson stuff and the Red Skull's involved. We'll get there eventually as we keep doing these discussions. But what was it like for you to revisit the first appearance of Sam Wilson on his little Falcon adventure?
I don't understand why he was there. I don't understand why they decided to drop him in the middle of the story. Such a missed opportunity that I think the later MCU versions of him does very well because of the times, but it was fun to see him pop up this way.
He's just so hot. He's in that, like, low cut shirt. Like,
yeah, it was always super slutty in the 60s for everyone.
So the Red Skull here, where I kind of drew the comparison of the German-American Bund, which has very Ku Klux Klan kind of thought patterns, the idea of America first, or kind of this pure American blood. It's an uncomfortable comparison to what's happened in modern times. We see the Red Skull kind of promoting this, but we also see his allies in the exiles who are drawing power through slave labor, but only until they are convinced to fight back. So fascism is kind of the topic of the day as we're exploring this in these old stories from a modern lens. What were some of the highlights of this story that kind of struck you a little bit?
Like I said before, when you understand who Red Skull is, much like Dr. Doom, you kind of understand their intent. Their intent is to take over the world by any means necessary. I mean, Dr. Doom has a heart. Red Skull does not, because of just the byproduct of the time.
So the funny part is the next conversation is going to be the Red Skull taking over Latveria.
yeah, which is always hysterical. They got this dialogue, which he's like, I kind of understand what's happening. And when I get this Cosmic Cube, it's going to be that much more better for me. Like, he was just like, this whole thing is going to not just only change me, but it's going to change the world. And I'm going to be in the forefront for it. So, like, again, I always believe that he was very clear in what he wants. And I think a lot of times the bad guys get very muddled. They have this weird kind of convoluted backstory. Red Skull was like, no, this is world domination at its finest. And I think that's always going to be the highlight for Red Skull.
I don't know. The racism is, of course, you know, just dripping from his there. Lips, this kind of purity of whiteness as the kind of motivation for his evil. But we frame it in, when we look at the modern lens of, like, we are giving something to you by putting us on top. We're going to turn you against immigrants in order to be our own. And the uncomfortable part, again, we're not releasing this till later this year, but we're recording this in early June during Pride, but right around the headlines where all of the stuff in LA is happening. We have people kind of on protest against the horrible things happening with ICE and, like, the military force force being turned against the populace. It's a direct parallel, and it's so deeply uncomfortable when we're kind of stacking them up next to each other.
Because history repeats itself. The history is always doomed to repeat itself. We're like, you know, when you look at the things that are happening now, you literally can look in the history books and see that's what led to the start of the Holocaust. So it's like, it's actually soul grating to see it happening in and then going back to comics and seeing how it was back then and how people address it. It's kind of wild.
We can't put Donald Trump and the Red Skull in the same origin story. You know,
some people can. I believe that he found a Calcium Cube. I definitely believe he found, or reality. So whatever he found, he found.
I was just going to draw this comparison. The Red Skull, though, you know, was like a poor orphan in Nazi Germany who was hand selected by Hitler, right? Trump comes from like generational wealth. But if you saw the Fallen House of Usher, the Fall of the House of Usher on Netflix recently, there's the parallel of like the rich guy at the end who made the deal with the devil, that he would always be fortunate. And they draw some very clear Trump parallels, like the dark things that are happening as the result of him using kind of cosmic power to grow to strength. That seems like another version of this, which is deeply uncomfortable as well. What would Donald Trump do with a cosmic cube that he hasn't already? I'm not sure.
I don't. There again, the implications are all there. You can see it. You can see again all of the parallels and how conversations from the 60s are happening now and still. And it's just exhausting and it's just incredible. It's incredible to behold that we're still in it.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah. There's also this obsession in the story with Red Skull over and over again, like switching forms. I'm gonna trap Cap and hide him in the version of me with the red mask on, right? But also I'm gonna on his body. We're going to see that again and again and again. That kind of swap is always interesting, which is very much Nazism under the guise of patriotism. It's like a very weird cartoony parallel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And others giving me kind of stink face as we realize that. It's like, ugh.
Yeah. I'm just like, no, again, it's not until you start putting it into these contexts that, you know, things start to kind of like bubble up. You're like, oh shit, I never really thought about it like that. And then you're prone to view change. And then again, it's just like comic books have always been at the forefront of just storytelling. And then when you get a lens like this, it shows you like just the world and realities and how it just harkens back all the time. You're just like, how did we not see that?
Yeah. And then the last parallel I'll draw here, once the Red Skull gets the cosmic cube, it's not the first or the last time, but there's some really funny things. First, he makes himself giant. Look how much bigger I am than you, Cap. And then he spots him across the universe, basically saying you're irrelevant. And he could leave it there. But no, he's like, I want to bring it back and like make you pay by making people think you are me. That's the worst thing I can do to torture you, right? Like, again, not subtle.
You need to see it through my eyes, which again is not irrelevant. That, you know, there are certain GOP representatives and hardcore MAGA whose only reason to live is just so you can understand them. You have to see my point of view in order for us to like even have a conversation,
right? And we've reached a point in government where, you know, in order to succeed at all, you have to ally with the people who are openly crazy and racist, like your only option. But there's this parallel of the Falcon kind of leading the uprising, right? Here's this man of color turning a whole island of people of color, reminding them that they don't have to do things the way that they've been doing it.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the beauty of this story for me.
Well, also the beauty of the story that somehow the Red Skull knew that the Falcon was not from Haiti and indeed was from Harlem, just from his voice. I was like, how do you figure that out?
But also the Red Skull, when he got his cosmic power, also did not do anything for his allies. In fact, he turned against
you.
I'm better than all of you. So this like Trump fallout that's happening. It's crazy.
Absolutely.
It's crazy. Do you have any final thoughts, my friend?
Nothing. Absolutely. No final thoughts on this. Again, I just, it always just is about the world, the state of things, and how we have to study history in order for it not to repeat. Like that's literally just what I've been noticing and just observing. Like things are just happening way too much. I mean, we've got people in common who are in LA right now who are dealing with these things. You know, I've got some friends who are dealing with relatives who are immigrants. They're not necessarily legal, but at this point, anything goes.
Well, so, Andre Mason, thank you for joining me for this. Everybody stay tuned. We'll be back.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.